Well, good evening. It's time for us to get started. I'm not quite sure why I'm in a hurry. We had one of those moments that you have where I grabbed my notes to hold them for a second while Brooke was loading all of our stuff that we needed to take and set them back down rather than giving them to her or putting them with the stuff we're supposed to take. So my notes are relatively thin this evening, which basically means whatever's on the screen are my notes and whatever I managed to remember. So we'll see how this goes tonight. I think we'll do all right with it. We're starting our discussion of imprecatory psalms tonight, and we'll talk about more of what that is if that's not something that's familiar to you. We'll look at a couple of them. And I imagine that that'll take most of our time tonight, and then next week we'll come back and talk about kind of the conundrum of the imprecatory psalms, which is what do Christians today do with these kinds of things? And again, if that doesn't make any sense to you, why that would be a question, it'll become more clear as we continue on. So we'll be looking at a couple of these tonight, and that's kind of where we're headed. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you for this evening that we have to come and study your word and to continue to think of how holy men of the past have prayed to you and learn from their examples. And we ask that as we continue to do so this evening, we would be filled with wisdom and understanding to see these things that you have preserved for us and to properly apply them as we come and talk to you in our own lives. Be with us always, and especially as we consider your word. In Jesus we pray. Amen. All right. So, like I said, I'm kind of flying solo this evening, so I'll probably be looking at the screen more than typical, but we'll work our way through this together one way or the other. So let's start with something of a brief description of these imprecatory psalms, just in case this is something that's completely unfamiliar to you. This is really something of a subset of laments. Laments are these very negative kinds of psalms that are complaining about various things. We talked last time about penitential psalms, which is another subset of them, where really they're complaining about their own sin as they repent of their sin. Imprecatory psalms are a very different kind of subset. They're complaining about the enemy again, and using very harsh kinds of language in these prayers. So they are laments. They're laments of very strong emotion. Because they have the same typical features of other laments, that's why they're grouped in with laments. And again, this is descriptive, not prescriptive, which is to say that, you know, Bible scholars today look at all the different psalms and try to group them by shared character traits. It's not like in ancient Hebrew world, there was a list of traits of a lament, and if you wanted to write a lament, you had to follow the list. So it's just kind of describing what is there, but it shares those kinds of features. But what makes them distinct as a group is the imprecatory psalms call on God not just to deliver them from their enemy, as many of the laments do, but to curse the enemy. Sometimes even to kill the enemy, sometimes to do bad things to the enemy's family. Sometimes it calls blessings on those who will do these things to their enemy. And so that's what makes them distinct. That's what makes them a bit shocking to the Christian reader. And that's what is going to lead us, next class, really, to the question that we have to wrestle with, which is, what do Christians today do with these kinds of psalms? And there are a variety of options that have been suggested over the years, and we'll talk through a lot of those next time. Tonight, I'm going to try to avoid talking about that too much. So as you have comments and questions, if they're about the ethical dilemma of imprecatory psalms, save them and think about them. I want you to have a good week to kind of mull that over before we come back to that. But let that marinate for a little while, because it's an interesting question. Now, for what it's worth, the word imprecate is a word that we don't use a whole lot, but the word means to invoke evil upon somebody or something else. That's where this word imprecatory psalm comes from. It's kind of an unfortunate word just because we never use it. But if they were called cursing psalms, that just really wouldn't work in English either. So it's just kind of what we're stuck with. So that's the basic description of them. That's pretty straightforward, I think. No questions or comments to this point? That's a good way to shut down discussion, right? No questions. No. Go ahead, Jonathan. That's a good question and one I'd have to look more into to find out. I know that it's not just like a postmodern kind of issue. So it's not like, you know, 20th, 21st century as Christians become, you know, we're the smartest people who've ever lived kind of thing. C.S. Lewis, for example, thought they were uninspired hatefulness of the psalmist. So to give you an idea of someone who is pretty well regarded as a great thinker of Christianity, kind of in broad terms, has that perspective. I'd have to look a little bit more closely to see how far back that kind of attitude goes. My guess is it's a question that goes back to the beginning, at least on some level. That's a good question, though. Any other questions here? Jeremy, you don't know anything about that issue, do you? Your church history work? It's a very good question. We'll come back to that next week. You view them with your eyes as you look at the page. All right. The other thing that's interesting about this is that this is something that's not limited to the book of Psalms. And I think that's something that's helpful, which will serve as something of backdrop to our discussion next week. And so I want to give you that now. But there are curses like this that run throughout the Old Testament. You don't have to look very far. And of course, because I don't have my notes, I don't have any examples written down, and I can't think of any off the top of my head. But I do have some examples for the New Testament, because this is the one that's even more surprising. It's probably not surprising to you to find out that there are curses called on enemies in the Old Testament outside the book of Psalms. If they're inside the book of Psalms, what is more shocking is to find them in the New Testament. Paul does it several times. Galatians 5 is really a shocking sort of one, and depending on what your translation does with it, may make it a little bit more subtle than it actually is. But here Paul is talking about those Judaizing teachers who are going around and saying that Gentile Christians had to be circumcised if they were going to be Christians, and trying to impose Judaism into Christianity. And he says in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 12, "I wish those who unsettle you would emasculate themselves," which is just a shocking thing to hear Paul say. And the idea, especially in this context of circumcision, is you're so hung up on circumcision, what we might say colloquially is, "I wish the knife would slip while you're circumcising yourself," is the idea, which is, again, just a shocking sort of thing. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 20, picking up at the end of verse 19, "By rejecting this," that is, the faith, the charge that he's entrusted to Timothy, "by rejecting this, some have made shipwreck of their faith, among whom are Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I handed over to Satan, that they may learn not to blaspheme." And then in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 14, "Alexander the coppersmith did me great harm. The Lord repay him according to his deeds." And then one other one that I don't have up here that comes to mind as well is when Jesus curses the fig tree. Now, that is in itself something of a parable, but when you stop and you think about that, that fig tree represents something in that parable, and it is, in essence, calling a curse down on a group of people as well. And so you find this kind of language in the New Testament and in the Old Testament in addition to the Psalms, and so that may be something to keep in mind, too, as we work our way through the question here. Now, the ones that are the most intense throughout, if you want to look at them in some more detail over the week, 35, 69, and 109. We'll look at 109 some today, and we'll look at 137 today. Those are the most intense ones all the way through. 137 is not as intense of a psalm from beginning to end, but the last verse of that psalm, verse 9, is universally agreed on as about the worst verse in the Bible. This is the kind of thing that I've read, I want to say, at least two different authors who came to Christendom in a broad sense from, you know, various kinds of backgrounds, one of whom was an atheist, and he'd like to quote this verse to believers just to shock them, and another who grew up in the church in some sense, but was something of a smart aleck, would, like at summer Bible camp, when they're each, you know, sharing their life verse or whatever, would stand up and read this verse and let everyone be dealing with the shock of that. So it's a striking thing, and we'll come to that in just a moment. We'll look at Psalm 137 first. But they're just surprising. If you've never read these before or thought about them in terms of just basically what they actually say, because that's another thing, it's easy to read them and think, well, it can't possibly mean that. No, they do mean that. That's the shocking thing about the imprecatory Psalms, is they mean exactly what they're saying, which is they want God to come get their enemy and, you know, get them good, is basically the idea there. Now, the typical perspective in these, and again, you can look through the different imprecatory psalms that I have listed, and you can look for this perspective, and you'll find it in varying degrees. You know, each point obviously more or less emphasized from one psalm to the next. But basically, the psalmist feels like he has been repaid good with evil, so he's been doing good things, he's been doing the right thing. We'll see that specifically in Psalm 109. This evening, he's been acting like a friend, and he has been betrayed, and he has been repaid evil for good, is the idea in a lot of these. And there's no good reason that this is happening. It's not like, I've done something terrible, and it's just come back on me. And it doesn't even seem like, you know, denial. It's, you know, one of those things that a lot of people that have bad things come back on them when they deserve it. They're just really in denial about what they've been doing. It's kind of like, you know, you go down to the prison and, you know, ask for a survey, get all the prisoners in a room, ask for a survey. How many of you are actually guilty? No hands go up. How many of you are innocent? All the hands go up. So it's not that kind of delusional. It's I've actually been doing good things for people, and they're treating me wrong. There's no reason for this. And the psalmist will go on to say that I'm continuing to do what is right in spite of this. In spite of the fact that I did good, I was repaid evil for that good, I'm being mistreated and unfairly treated, my enemies are out to get me, and they're going to get me, but I'm still going to do the right thing in the midst of all of this. Sometimes, not always, they understand their suffering as being suffering for the Lord. That they're not just suffering innocently, but they're suffering for God in some kind of way. Their enemies are opposed to God very often. There is a interesting contrast, comparison, you might say, a couple of ideas running side by side, that they've lost all confidence in their fellow man whatsoever because of the situation. Yet as their confidence in their fellow man wanes, their confidence in God grows stronger and stronger. So you'll find that kind of balance of the scales, so to speak, shifting in these psalms. And then also, interestingly, in a lot of these, it remembers the broader community, that it's not just the psalmist and his enemy, but it extends beyond that initial situation to some relationship to the community as well. Sometimes it's that kind of, you know, call to praise at the end that you find in a lot of these laments that take it to a broader perspective. Sometimes it's just something that runs through the psalm, this focus on a more communal kind of aspect. So those are the kinds of things you can expect to see in these imprecatory psalms. And I think, yeah, that's basically what I've got to say by way of introduction to them. So now's a good point, again, for me to stop and ask for questions or comments, and then we'll look at a couple of them, which should take up most of the rest of our time this evening. Yeah.
Justice.
Yeah, and some of these psalms in particular are quoted as being fulfilled in Jesus. Psalm 109, we'll see later, is quoted by Peter when, I think it's when Matthias replaces Judas. It's quoted in that kind of context. Psalm 69 is quoted several times. I was hoping I could flip over there and see one easily, and I'm not. So you'll have to look at Psalm 69 and find all the messianic foreshadowing in that on your own. That's your homework. Bring back a list. It'll be on the test. I think there is this idea of it being redemptive and finding Christ in these. In fact, there are some, and we'll probably... We'll mention this a little bit later on, but some even see that really terrible verse, Psalm 137 and verse 9, as potentially being a messianic kind of idea as well. So we'll talk about that in a moment. Any other comments here at this point? All right, Psalm 137 then. This is the basic outline of it. What's going on in this psalm? This is the one we talked about earlier that kind of gives us a possible last psalm, one of the very later ones that's written. They are in Babylonian captivity, and they're being taunted by their captors, and they basically refuse to do what they're being asked to do. So they're in terrible conditions that are described in verses 1 through 3. They speak of their unswerving allegiance to God in verses 4 through 6, and then there is this plea for divine vindication, including a curse on their enemies, in verses 7 through 9, which includes the Edomite betrayal of the Israelites, which is one of the things that happened when Jerusalem was being destroyed. The Babylonians were destroying Jerusalem. The Edomites who lived nearby, who were relatives of the Israelites, distant relatives, but relatives nonetheless, the forefather of each nation, they were brothers. They, instead of helping out their kindred, kind of stood on the sidelines and cheered for the Babylonians, was basically the idea, joined in the plundering later on. And he issues a blessing for doing to the Babylonians what the Babylonians did to them, and in particular, a blessing for those who kill the Babylonian children. And that's the shocking one. So with that basic outline, we'll go ahead and read through it. By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our lyres, for there our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. Let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem, how they said, lay it bare down to its foundations. O daughter of Babylon, doomed to be destroyed, blessed shall he be who repays you with what you have done to us. Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock. Well, a couple things that I'll mention here. Again, we see them in Babylonian captivity. Here, hanging up their instruments, the idea being that they're not going to participate, they're not going to sing. But the idea in verse 3 of the captors requiring of us songs and mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion, probably what's going on here is not that we really like this Israelite music so much we'd like to hear some of it. It's probably more, tell us about how great your God is, you who are our captives, and you who, your God wasn't able to save you from us and our God. Remember, that's kind of the view in the ancient world. Among the pagan nations is each kind of geographic locality had its own deity that was in charge of that region. And when two nations went to war, whoever's God was the strongest was the one that was going to win. And if you're fighting on your own turf, you're more likely to win because your God's going to have more power in your region than, you know, somewhere else. So for the Babylonians to go into Palestine and defeat them on their own God's turf, what that means to the Babylonians is our God's stronger than your God, basically, would be how they saw it. So for them to require, you know, these great songs of Zion, and it's not just an Israelite ditty, you know, it's a song of Zion. It's talking about worship of God, that kind of music. It's a taunt is what it is. Tell us more about how strong your God is, you captives, is kind of the idea. And so the response is, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to hang up our lyres, we're going to hang up our instruments, and we're not going to sing these songs. And if I forget you, in verses 5 and 6, it's kind of almost a call for a curse upon himself. If I turn my back on God, if I forget Jerusalem, if I forget the Lord, which I think he's equating with, you know, singing one of these songs in a foreign land and accepting this kind of taunt against God, the curse is, let my right hand forget its skill, let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth. And probably that's related to the context, which is these are instrumentalists and singers. It's not my right hand forgetting its skill, and I'm a fantastic tennis player, and I'm going to lose that ability to play tennis. I'm going to lose my backhand because I've, you know, sung this song. No, it's playing the instrument is the idea. And the tongue is, you know, it's not just I won't be able to talk. It's the tongue for singing in this context. So those things that are directly related to the singing is what they're, you know, calling curses on. I mean, my guess is these would be temple musicians who are being taunted, those who were involved in the singing and writing of psalms anyway. And so they're asking God to take away the things they do best if they participate in this and forget Jerusalem and not set Jerusalem above their highest joy. All right, any thoughts on the first six verses in particular? We'll talk about the curses at the end in just a moment. Questions about anything? It seems pretty straightforward, I think. All right, well, that then leads us to these last three verses, the remembering the Edomites, remembering Babylon, blessing those who do to Babylon what Babylon did to them, blessing the one who takes the little ones and dashes them against the rock. Now, a very straightforward reading of this is clear. It's the psalmist saying, God, get the Edomites and get the Babylonians and bless those who do it, including the killing of their children, which is, you know, part of what the Babylonians would have done. It's just kind of one of the specific things the Babylonians did to them. And that's how I understand it. I think that's the best way to understand it. If you try to overly spiritualize it, if you try to make it mean something other than what it very clearly says, well, you know, maybe he doesn't mean, you know, bless those who repay you with what you have done to us. Maybe, you know, it's something other than, I just don't know how you can get around reading it as what it says. Now, like I said, there are some who take verse 9 in a messianic sense. You think of a couple of places in the New Testament this language is used. The stone which should be the cornerstone, the foundation stone, was rejected, and it will crush those who rejected it. Maybe you can find some idea of that kind of imagery in the New Testament relating back to this. I'm not sure that I buy that as the only interpretation. I'm pretty sure I don't want to buy that as the only interpretation. How strong of a possibility it is another sort of matter. But that's an interesting, perhaps, way of considering it. Well, yeah, it's one of those. I don't know how you can interpret this psalm thoroughly through that lens. I think you can say there is a sense in which Jesus is the rock that crushes his enemies. But how does that help you understand this for 400 years before Jesus was around? That's a different kind of question. Jeremy?
Yeah, I think it's more of a lex talionis justice that he's calling out for. Turn that evil upon your head, you know.
Yeah, and that's, I think, really there are two curses here. The curse against the Edomites and the curse against the Babylonians. And then verse 9 is just kind of an extension and a specification of what is kind of the among the worst of the crimes that the Babylonians would have committed in ancient warfare. And it's a way of saying, blessed shall he be who repays you with what you've done to us, even this terrible, terrible thing, is kind of the way I understand verse 9 as it relates to it. So yeah, I think it is this eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, baby head for baby head sort of thing. Ultimately, it's going to be fulfilled in Cyrus. He's the one who leads the Persian Empire to rise up and destroy the Babylonians. Now, Cyrus was not commanding the army when they marched into Babylon, and actually when Babylon fell. But obviously, he's still in charge of everything at that point. So, any other thoughts here? Like I said, we'll come back next time and try to make some sense of what to do with this as Christians. It certainly sounds offensive and shocking. Like I said, you imagine if you're at that summer Bible camp or whatever, and someone asks someone to stand up and read their life verse, and they get up and read this, how that would impact you, especially if you're not very well versed in the Bible as a teen. And you hear this, and it's the first time you've ever heard this verse. What on earth is this stuff doing in the Bible? Is one of those kinds of questions that comes up as it relates to this. All right, we'll go ahead and flip back to Psalm 109. And we'll see how Psalm 109 goes. This is the one that typically when I'm teaching this elsewhere, I try to get through all of this in one class, and I didn't want to rush through it here. So typically I just talk about 137, and then we talk about the ethical thing. So I added 109 for tonight and jotted down a whole bunch of notes this morning that would be just fantastic to talk about. They're on the kitchen table, so we'll see how much of it I actually remember. Psalm 109 is organized interestingly. It's almost one of those ABCBA things that you see a whole lot, and you start to expect it after the ABC there. But then what happens is B gets paralleled, C gets paralleled, and then it comes back to A at the end. So it begins with an invocation to the God of praise in verse 1. It ends with a benediction of the God of praise. And then you have two kind of parallel sections in the middle. The words and acts of the ungodly in verses 2 through 5, paralleled by the acts and the words of the ungodly in a different kind of emphasis in verses 16 through 20. And then you've got an imprecation in verses 6 through 15, which is the bulk of the psalm, and then a prayer in verses 21 through 29, which are parallel to one another. So that's the way this psalm is basically put together. If that's helpful to you to see how things are put together, that's the way it's put together. If it's not helpful, feel free to ignore it. And we'll go ahead and read through this. Be not silent, O God of my praise, for wicked and deceitful mouths are opened against me, speaking against me with lying tongues. They encircle me with words of hate and attack me without cause. In return for my love, they accuse me, but I give myself to prayer. So they reward me evil for good and hatred for my love. Appoint a wicked man against him. Let an accuser stand at his right hand. When he is tried, let him come forth guilty. Let his prayer be counted as sin. May his days be few. May another take his office. There's the verse that Peter quotes in relation to Matthias taking the office of Judas. May another take his office. May his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. May his children wander about and beg, seeking food far from the ruins they inhabit. May the creditor seize all that he has. May strangers plunder the fruits of his toil. Let there be none to extend kindness to him, nor any to pity his fatherless children. May his posterity be cut off. May his name be blotted out in the second generation. May the iniquity of his fathers be remembered before the Lord, and let not the sin of his mother be blotted out. Let them be before the Lord continually, that he may cut off the memory of them from the earth. For he did not remember to show kindness, but pursued the poor and needy, and brokenhearted to put them to death. He loved to curse, let curses come upon him. He did not delight in blessing, May it be far from him. He clothed himself with cursing as his coat. May it soak into his body like water, like oil into his bones. May it be like a garment that he wraps around him, like a belt that he puts on every day. May this be the reward of my accusers from the Lord, of those who speak evil against my life. But you, O God, my Lord, deal on my behalf for your name's sake, because your steadfast love is good, deliver me. For I am poor and needy, and my heart is stricken within me. I am gone like a shadow at evening. I am shaken off like a locust. My knees are weak through fasting. My body has become gaunt with no fat. I am an object of scorn to my accusers. When they see me, they wag their heads. Help me, O Lord my God. Save me according to your steadfast love. Let them know that this is in your hand. You, O Lord, have done it. Let them curse, but you will bless. They arise and are put to shame, but your servant will be glad. May my accusers be clothed with dishonor. May they be wrapped in their own shame as in a cloak. With my mouth I will give great thanks to the Lord. I will praise him in the midst of the throng, for he stands at the right hand of the needy to save him from those who condemn his soul to death. All right, let me just start this psalm by asking if there are any observations or questions, anything that kind of stands out to you about this psalm as we just read through it. Yeah. So verse 9, may his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. Verse 12, let there be none to extend kindness to him, nor any to pity his fatherless children. That's one of the constant indictments in the prophets is they failed to take care of the needy, and the orphans and the widows and the foreigners in particular are emphasized in that kind of context. And so now he's asking for this very thing to happen to them, not only for them to become orphans and a widow, but then for no one to take care of them. Is that what he means? Why would he say such a thing?
And then he says in 30 that God has been at the right hand of the poor.
Yeah. He stands at the right hand of the needy. And there's another verse, verse 16, where he's talking about his enemy. He did not remember to show kindness, but pursued the poor and needy and the brokenhearted to put them to death. And that, I think, may be something of an answer to your question, because in particular, when you look at verse 17, he loved to curse, so let curses come upon him. He did not delight in blessing, so may blessing be far from him. The idea, again, is this kind of eye for an eye, retribution, justice. You did this bad thing, so this bad thing should come upon you. You didn't do this good thing, so you don't want this good thing. You know, we don't want this good thing to come upon you. So then you back that up a verse to, he didn't show kindness. He pursued the poor and the needy and the brokenhearted to put them to death. So I think then in that context that what those verses about his wife and children is more of this retribution justice. May this be done to you that you did to others, this done to your family that you did to others, I think is probably the idea there. It's just not quite as one-to-one as it is in verse 17. Yeah, Jonathan. I think it's more along the lines of this seems to be set in the context of like a court trial. Verse 7 in particular, when he's tried, let him come forth guilty. And I think the idea is whether this is actually going to be something that's taken to a court or not. The idea is to depict the psalmist and his enemy in this kind of scene. We're going to trial together. And so there's going to be a judge who's going to sit in judgment over you. and whether, you know, a wicked man is appointed against him because that's the kind of person who's going to do worse to him may be part of the idea. It may just be because a lot of wicked people are judges. Judges are wicked people. Or that God could use anybody. That may be the idea as well. I mean, you think of Habakkuk and this idea of God using a wicked person to accomplish his just purposes. Romans 13, the sword, you know, or the government bears the sword for the justice of the Lord. Well, that's a Nero's Rome that Paul's talking about, accomplishing the justice of God. So whether it's specifically, I want a wicked man, or even a wicked man can do it, or even if it is a wicked man, the right thing will be done. I think any of those could be possible in there. But yeah, I think it helps to see it in that kind of trial context. Jonathan? Splash damage.
Yeah. If the wicked man gets what he deserves, they're going to be caught up in it. And so you describe roundabout what the wicked man deserves by the consequences.
I would have to look at it more closely and or talk to somebody who knows the original grammar better. My understanding is the grammar is pronouncing curses, not speaking in a future what's going to happen kind of pronouncement. That may his children be fatherless means may his children be fatherless, not his children will become fatherless. I mean, I'd have to look at that to be 100% certain, but that's my understanding from what I've read in the past as well as I can remember right now. That is one of the very common explanations. We'll talk about that some next time. One of the explanations to try to soften these is it's just future pronouncements is all that it is, that he's not actually calling down curses, he's just saying this is what God is going to do. But to me, that doesn't square with the language overall. Now, it may work in some cases, but as an overall solution to all of the imprecatory psalms, it just doesn't square with it. So, Adam, were you going to say something there? Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Does